You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Rachel Rush. Rachel is a wonderful actor and now is embarking on a new part of her path, having just graduated with dual master's degrees. Rachel and I acted in The Food Odyssey together a few years ago, which was a really special project you've heard me talk about. And although she had been friends with a lot of my close friends for years, we only became close during that play. And I'm so grateful she's in my life. I really respect the way she moves through the world with such generosity and love. And I'm very happy to talk to her about artistry and creativity for the podcast. I hope you enjoy the 34th episode of The Compass. Okay, so I want to talk about a ton of things with you, but I feel like I usually start with the dark side question, but I feel like I kind of want to get there in more of a circuitous route since you're pursuing so many different things right now. Mm-hmm. So you just graduated.
I did.
With two master's degrees.
I know.
Can you tell us a little bit about those, what those are, so we know where you are right now in your life?
Sure. So 2 weeks ago now, I graduated from a dual degree master's program, a three-year program, wherein I got a master's degree in child development from Sarah Lawrence College and a master's degree in social work from NYU.
And do the two programs work together?
They work together.
Okay.
So I think we're like the 11th or 12th cohort that's done the dual degree. It's a small group. There was five of us when we started and four of us when we graduated. One gal's graduating next year. She was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So it's small, but the two schools work together so that our programming complements each other, that our internships for social work school are really focused and our interest in the old children and family work. And it's a really kind of circular, nurtured program. I feel really lucky to be a part of it.
That's so cool that it's sort of small.
It is. I think I was just speaking to our kind of head professor at Sarah Lawrence, and she was saying she's often been encouraged to make it larger.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the writing program there, for example, the graduate program, it was something like 30-something graduates, it seemed like, that day. But she thinks, which I agree with, that keeping it kind of small helps us nurture each other. We all became very close and really connected to each other.
Mm-hmm.
With the kind of work that we're doing, working with various populations of children and family who really need a lot of support, I think being able to be close to one another and work with one another helps us, you know, keep our own buoyancy and our own, you know, kind of self-care in check, too.
Yeah, I was going to ask that because it's such a, you're dealing with people who are dealing with so much stress and so much pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found, even, I know you're about to embark on, like, the professional side of it, but have you found that it takes a toll on you, on your stress levels? And
that's interesting, you know, kind of, especially in the context of this podcast and, you know, the idea of struggle or of when one's heart feels weighted or when the sadness can take over. I feel like, for me, there's a lot of connection to how I live my life as an actor. That nurtures myself as a clinician and as a social worker, you know, looking for connectivity and friendship and the things that are outside of the work. For me, I mean, when I was having a hard time as an actor, seeing the things outside of my work that could fill my heart or what led me to social work school. And while I've been in school and had harder moments, you know, going and seeing a play or being a part of a reading has really helped kind of provide balance and make each aspect of my life kind of work in concert with each other in a way that I feel very lucky for. You know, they teach us in social work school about self-care and about, you know, really having a lens on that, but I feel really lucky that I think kind of built into my life were ways to have alternate interests and alternate parts of myself that could then free me from any days that were particularly hard.
And probably, like, self-reflection, too.
Absolutely.
I feel like as actors, we're a little more tuned into that, to be aware of when something's sticking with you or bothering you. Or
and aware when your heart feels
Heaviness,
you know. But for me, the work itself, I'm working, so I last year was working in pediatric oncology and specialized in pediatric palliative care, so working with kids who have complex medical needs and their families. The work itself is very rewarding. You know, I know it sounds kind of like a downer, but and there are days, of course, that are so just tragic and difficult, but there's a lot of play and a lot of joy and a lot of hope and a lot of community in a way that I think is similar to the world of theater and acting. And it's like when those moments are present or when I can bring those moments to the work, it feels great. You know?
Yeah. And I mean, we didn't really become close. I knew that you were friends with tons of my friends for a long time, but until you were already in grad school.
Right, right.
Can you tell me a little bit about what brought you to that decision?
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to jump the gun with the dark side question, but
no,
it really
please.
Does kind of come from that like genesis of a point in that I was having a really hard time and a really hard moment with only being an actor and also just kind of going so hard. Like, I'm a person who like invests all of myself into something, and I don't mean to sound prescriptive at all, but there's one day where I sat down with a mentor of mine. You know, I'd been in the city for a few years, and I was just really like, I don't know why I feel so unfulfilled, even when I have like a job or some auditions and things like that. I just felt like, to me, when I've listened to your podcast, to me the dark side feels like depletion,
mm-hmm.
when I'm pouring out more than is being poured back into my heart, and it just leaves me feeling very low. You know? And she said to me, you know, it's good to find balance, again, speaking of balance, but find the things in your life that fill you up, you know, or kind of provide additional life experience for you, whether that's falling in love or going traveling or cooking or volunteering. And that conversation really stuck with me. And I had been, at the time, sort of ignoring this impulse to want to start to volunteer more, particularly with the world of kids and illness. And so I started as an administrative volunteer for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and that like led to the next thing and to the next thing and to the next thing. I was a camp counselor for a while at this place called Double H Ranch, a volunteer camp counselor, which is like an upstate camp for kids with various medical complexities. And I started volunteering at the 52nd Street Project, a place that's very dear to my heart, that connects kids in the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood of Manhattan with theater artists and other types of artists to promote create unique work. And there I started working with a girl who has special physical needs, and just it kept growing. Like, that work kept becoming a bigger part of my life and a part of my life that I was nurturing more than like going out and getting another agent or, you know, doing
right.
that kind of work. And so I just kind of found myself in the same year auditioning for acting graduate schools and applying for social work school. I was accepted to NYU at the time, and I deferred for a year because I was also waitlisted at Juilliard at that same time. And it felt like the things were too close. So I spent another year just kind of exploring and thinking and talking a lot to friends and journaling a lot and just feeling like, where was my heart trying to bring me? And that's when I learned about the dual degree program, and I thought, oh, that feels sort of right if I got in, you know?
Right.
That feels sort of lovely, you know? And so I applied, and I went to interview, and I was so nervous, and everyone around me I thought was way smarter and more skilled. I'm like, I'm an actor! and I got in, and the day that I found out that I made it into Sarah Lawrence and therefore could do the dual degree, I felt like a similar kind of, or the same kind of happiness as to like getting a big break, a big like part I've always wanted. Just felt like something in me that is like myself was lit up.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It was still scary, and still, I still questioned it, you know, and I still was unsure even until the first day of school. But now I'm really glad that, that advice to kind of just follow what fills you up, you know, led me to this sort of new place that I would never ever thought that I would be at.
Right. That's crazy that you were applying for, like, kind of at the two paths that diverge.
Yeah, it's a little strange. And I remember saying to people at the time, sort of like, yeah, I'm, like, applying to social work school and I'm auditioning for Juilliard. Or I'm like,
I understand that feeling, like, that you need, you know, you need a big change in one way or another.
Yeah. And I think it sort of, I think I likened it at the time because I like a good metaphor because I'm a big sap. But, like, throwing out a lot of seeds and, like, watering them all and, like, just seeing what grows and seeing what takes and seeing which ones I want to continue to, you know, which ones, like, keep calling me back, and I don't know what would have happened if I had been accepted to Juilliard that year. You know,
What choice you would have made.
Right. I think about that sometimes. You know, when I found out I was waitlisted, I both felt sad just because I'd enjoyed my weekend there so much, but I also felt a little relieved, or I felt like, all right, well, this is what information I'm being given, and it didn't feel as personal, you know, it didn't feel as much of a attack or statement at all on my work, you know. So yeah, it's been a kind of long road, you know. I looked at other professions, I looked at nursing, I looked at child life, which is a really specific kind of hospital work. I tried my hand at writing and, like, improv and things like that, but I just couldn't find a talent there for me. And yes, that's sort of how I found myself where I am now.
So when you were focusing on acting, what were the things that you reached for when you felt yourself going to that depleted, dark side space?
Yeah. You know, I've thought about this a lot in listening to your podcast. It's kind of like James Lipton at the end of, like, the Actor Studio. You know, how he has, like, that. That's his name, right?
Yeah, so I think so.
That, like, list of stock questions.
Uh-huh.
Like, what would you say at the pearly gate?
It always makes you wonder what your answer would be.
I know. Yeah. I'm like, what? Yeah.
What is my favorite curse word?
I know. What would I say if James Lipton were to interview me? But, so I thought about this a lot listening to your podcast. And, you know, for me, in my early 20s, when I first moved to New York, you know, I was, like, gonna make it, whatever that meant, at any cost. And, you know...
Did you major in acting in undergrad?
I went to Boston University.
That's right.
I was in their acting program. And was, like, an actor, speech and debater in high school. Like,
yeah.
Like, that's the end of the year. Like,
it's like, this is what you do.
Exactly. I was like, I am an actor. I think I was, you know, voted some award in my high school yearbook, and I was wearing an I Heart New York, like, you know, I'm that girl, you know, which is lovely and fine. But, so when I first came here, I was just going, and, like, the dark side was around, but I kept, like, ignoring it. Like, I once was working, it's like, audition, like, going to open calls constantly during the day, and I was working, you know, my day job from, like, 5 to 2 in the morning, and then there was one day I literally broke out into hives on one of my arms, because I wasn't, I mean, I was taking care of myself okay, like, I was still sleeping, still eating fine, and, like, exercising, but I felt like something in me was like, you gotta stop this.
Right.
But I didn't want to look at it, or if I felt sad, or I felt funky, I was like, well, I just have to do something different, well, I just have to,
I have to do more.
Exactly, yeah. I have to do more, maybe because I, you know, chose this headshot instead of that one. Next time I'll choose that headshot.
Right.
You know, it was like
the minutia.
Like something, yeah, like spiritual or cosmic that I could have done differently, and this is how I'm being treated or something, you know? And it wasn't until I have kind of a clear moment. I was probably like 23 or 24, like walking down the street, just feeling really sad, going to a rehearsal for a show that I enjoyed, but just feeling really low. And I was like, you know what? Just feel it. You know, just feel low. Like, go into the dark side a little bit. And almost immediately I started to feel lighter, you know, because I think I started to listen to myself, you know, and started to listen to what that was telling me, which at that time was like, you have to find balance. You know, this isn't the picture that when you're 16, you thought it was going to be, you know, there's no way to find that out until you live it. And now's the time to take different stock, take a breath, you know, cut back on your hours at that job, only go to the open calls if you, like, want to go to, or don't go if you don't want to one day, if you, like, need to go to a museum, like, take it easy, you know? And even still for me, when I feel funky or I feel kind of low or blue, I try to get a little still with it, you know? I try not to run away from it. I journal a lot. And that helps for talking to people. Therapy, I'm a big proponent of. Going for walks, things like that. But for me, like, when I feel it coming, the dark side, going into it, I find helpful.
Kind of what am I trying to tell myself?
Yeah. Yeah, what's inside that needs to be listened to that's making it? Because sadness is not a bad feeling. Anger is not a bad feeling. But I think that, I don't know, as a woman or as a person, I was not the culture to feel that way.
Yeah, that's something I think about a lot. I actually just read some article, maybe I'll put it on the podcast at some point, about how healthy anger is, but for most women, we're taught to ignore it or hide it for so long that when it does come out, it's in an unhealthy way because it's just been so repressed.
Right. Or that, like, feeling rageful at something is even okay, you know? I mean, of course, always it's holding these emotions in an appropriate and safe way, but, you know, I feel like feeling the thing and heading it face on is, you know, important.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I've perfected that at all, but...
No, me either, but it's a process.
Mm-hmm. Probably a lifelong one.
Uh-huh. I'm definitely better at it than I was 10 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
Can I ask, was any part of your transition, was any part of the thinking financial, your transition to taking a new thing? And not that social work is a known to be a lucrative career, but, I mean, that's part of the dark side for me when I'm not getting to act creatively, but I'm also not getting to make money from the way I'd like to, from the thing that I want to be doing.
Yeah.
Just curious.
Sure, I think that's a very important question. I do feel like there was some connection to that. Even sort of next to that, just being like having more control for me and control over my finances and control over, or just able to grasp onto what that part of my life will be. Stability absolutely was important to me. You know, I waited tables for a long time, and amidst every other job, I've had like every job you could have, but the waiting tables one was like one that stuck for a while. And I wanted the way I was making my money to be more aligned with making me feel good too, making my heart feel good.
Because otherwise, you're spending all the hours in your day.
You're
spending 10 hours doing something you don't enjoy to get the money to survive, and then 10 hours doing something you do enjoy on top of that.
Yeah.
And not getting the money.
Right. Which some people can do that and find fulfillment out of having that separation and balance. I respect that. But I felt like I wanted to be able to invest all of myself and be paid for it.
Yeah.
Which it feels a little weird to say out loud. You know, I wanted to be able to have my job be also something that...
Right, and have your basic needs be met at the same time.
Right. I had a family friend of mine who since passed away, but he was like, this is a really incredible doctor, and his father was a cartoonist. And he always... which is so random. He was a really head oncologist dude, and his brother invented the... oh gosh, what's that thing that you stand on? And you, like,
the Segway?
The Segway. His brother was one of the inventors of the Segway. And a brilliant guy, like, invented, like, a dialysis pump and all this kind of stuff.
Oh my gosh.
But when I first was connected to him, he's like, you know, I was still acting full time. He's like, I really admire what you're doing. I always used to watch my dad and be like, oh, if only I had the drawing talent. But I didn't. I was a doctor. But all to say, he's very...
Grass is always greener.
I know. He's like, all to say, like, you do have to find something that, it's like you work more of your life than you do anything else. So you have to find something, I think, that, you know, you can do what you love and be paid for it. Now, I feel like that can sometimes be a bit of an extreme, like find something you love and get paid for it. It's not, I think, totally the thing. But for me, I wanted more overlap.
Yeah. What do your parents do?
Sure. So my father is a judge.
That's right.
In the great state of Texas. He was an assistant district attorney for a long time, and then was a county court law judge, and now he's a state district judge. My mother stayed at home with us while we were growing up, and then she went back into work. She had a few jobs. She worked for a while at a nonprofit that helped underprivileged families in our community, and now she works at this, like, really cool young hip advertising firm. She's like,
oh my.
Yeah, she's out at, like, the front desk. She's like the mama bear. office. You know, she's not over. She does a lot of things there. Like,
right.
A lot of hats.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think she really loves it there. It seems like such a cool place. So that's what they do.
And your siblings?
My sister worked in the medical field for a while. She studied law in undergrad. She worked kind of on the administrative level at a hospital down in Dallas, and now mm-hmm. is a stay-at-home mom. And my brother kind of rides the line between artist and business person. He is, I think, gosh, I hope I say it right, the development coordinator at the DePaul School of Music, or he works in that field at the DePaul School of Music, which is his alma mater. He played with the student growing up, but also started business in college, so he could kind of have both worlds in his life.
Yeah. And how did your parents support you when you were pursuing acting, and now that you've done this transition?
Yeah.
What have they kind of made of that?
Yeah, that was tricky. So my dad's side has like a lot of lawyers and, you know, principals,
very
and teachers,
like professionals.
Yeah, my mom's side has a lot of also very successful family, like, you know, that really work hard. And I was only first sort of like, oh, I'm gonna do this. This thing in New York and like move far away and be an artist. But my parents were always so, I feel really lucky, really supportive. You know, my mom brought me to all my auditions for school, for undergrad, and like went around the corner, got my shoe cobbled and my heel like was falling off the night before an audition, you know. Never a stage mom, never over involved, but always really connected to it and really in love with it and really proud of it, you know. Tons of my shows when I was a theater, and really supported me moving to New York. I think that they had a hard time as I was having a hard time, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to, it's been said, but it's hard to explain to people who aren't in the field what it is.
Right.
What the reality is. So, like, you don't just go to New York and land on Broadway. You know?
Right. I mean, we're like, why don't you just get a better agent?
Exactly.
Oh, well.
Okay. You
want
to make that call for me? You want to make that happen for me?
Right.
Yeah, or like, why don't you just email this person and tell them to put you in a show? And I was like, well,
that's hard to explain.
I emailed that person a lot and they like me, but there's a whole other slew of things going on. You know?
Yeah.
But overall, they were incredibly supportive and kind and understanding. When I was first thinking about this transition, and even when I think up until when I kind of got in, they were. Is reticent too strong of a word? They were a little skeptical, wary, I think.
Of the commitment of going back to school?
Yeah, like shifting my lane so much, you know? Because I think they had invested so much in this path, you know? Part of like my backstory too is I was really sick when I was a kid. And, like really sick. And there was a time my mom was sort of like, please, if like she can stay, whatever heavens are, like I'll help her make her dreams come true.
Oh.
Which is the sweetest and the best. I hope she's okay with me saying that. But, you know, so I think that's like an example of how they had invested.
Right.
Just wholeheartedly in my, they wanted me to be a movie star. And to be
right. To see that particular dream come to fruition.
And it's been such a long dream. I mean, I was acting in elementary school.
Yeah.
And I was, Fern in our play of Charlotte's Web, you know, it's been throughout my, it was always the thing that I chose over any other, like, other interest. And, you know, there was discussion of, like, well, you do have this in your life, working with kids and with families because of your volunteer work, or, you know, we just don't want you to lose this thing you've been working on for so long. And I just kept trying to explain, like, it's not losing, it's just a continuation of my life. You know, it's just the next step. I don't see it as a diversion. I really don't. That could be naive, but I just see it as the next step. And as school went on, and as I took to it, because I even think that there's sort of like, will you enjoy being in an academic setting? You know, I went to conservatory undergrad, you know, and I had I'd taken a really rigorous academic class in a long time, you know, that I write a paper or anything like that. They became more kind of warm to the idea. I think hearing it in my voice and hearing that I wasn't calling home crying all the time anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, really, things culminated when they came up for my graduations 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I saw pride in their faces, you know, in a way that, you know, I feel like they get it fully now and are happy with the way things have kind of gone. So I'm very lucky for that. Very, very lucky for that.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, like the thought of that it's just your path continuing to grow and expand mm-hmm. instead of being like, I'm an actor and now I'm quitting acting to do this other thing.
Right.
Which I don't know if that's entirely helpful. So yeah. It's so black and white. Because it's also like, we did the Food Odyssey together when you were in school.
I was in graduate school, yeah.
Beautiful. You were amazing in it. And who's to say you're not going to be doing more acting things on the side while you're pursuing this new career?
And I do feel like, you know, there might be some people who would hear that and be like, well, you know, but I kind of like, I reject that a little bit. You know, I sort of feel like I know absolutely that my life as an actor will not look the same as it ever had before or be kind of the same trajectory probably. But I'm like, this is still my world. Those are still a lot of my friends. I go see a ton of plays all the time and act at the project or have done a couple of little readings here and there. And, it's just the volume of each might shift as I move forward. You know, I eventually would like to go more into private practice or teaching and writing, and who knows what time that will break up for me to invite the other thing in. But I feel like, you know, artistry can exist in both parts of my life, and it's like one road and I'm on it. I really don't feel like I've, if anything now, the more and more I talk about being an actor to social workers, like, oh yeah, we've met other actors who've been, it seems to actually really help you as a social worker, like, have deeper
empathy. You know how to communicate with people, you know how to listen, and yeah.
Somebody last week, I was on a phone call, and she was like, what was your undergrad in? I said, acting. She's like, you know, I'm not an actor, and maybe you'll disagree with this, but I think when an actor takes on, she's really sweet, when an actor takes on a role, you have to step into that person's shoes and imagine what their life is like and really have sympathy and compassion for that person. She's like, that's like the central tenet of social work is having empathy.
Yeah.
And I feel that 100,000,000%.
Yeah.
So if anything, like, I feel thankful to have had the 4 years of learning how to breathe and how to stay relatively present and you know, hold another person's experience.
Are there any surprising ways that you've found that you use your sense of creativity or artistry in this new work that have surprised you?
What a great question. This is so fun.
I love it.
So
we could talk all day.
I know. So I used to say to my mom something, like I got like my first job as a waitress when I was like 17 or 18 and I hated it so much. It was just like, and I remember my mom was sort of trying to teach me, it wasn't my first job, it was the first job I really loathed. She's like, well, that's, you know, kind of why it's called work. You gotta, like, kind of go back at it. And I was like, well, I guess that's why I want to do something called play. Like, so time, you know? And so just, like, high and mighty. But there is, I took courses in my child development, part of my studies. One was called play in the cultural and environmental perspective. You know, I learned about play therapy. You know, there is a lot of that kind of feeling of play and back and forth. Especially with kids,
yeah,
that is directly connected to acting work. You know, it's like improvising almost and saying yes, and you know, going off of what the person is giving back to you. And there's a play therapy class where she literally said something to the effect of, like, you never want to shut down the communication, you never want to, like, divert it, you want to kind of say yes to everything. The child is
You're like, I've heard this before,
yeah, that sounds a little familiar. You should come and teach an improv class or something, you know. So that was refreshing, I think.
Yeah. To be like, oh, I'm not coming at this from zero.
Right, yeah. Well, I have some.
I have skills that can...
toolbox,
yeah.
Can help me out already, too.
I listened to this podcast episode that is kind of related. Mm-hmm. It was coming at it from a different direction, but it's called The Longest Shortest Time, and it's like a parenting podcast that sometimes I listen to, but it's kind of like the This American Life of, like, parents' stories.
What's it called?
The Longest Shortest Time.
Oh,
but somebody had suggested to the host that she have a clown on to kind of like, what can a clown teach parents about parenting and this stuff? But this particular clown also does work with hospitals. I think with the Big Apple Circus, they have hospital clowns. And so he was talking a lot about that work, and he's a dad too, and about the things that he does with patients. And it was really, really interesting.
There's so many of those therapies, like music therapy, art therapy. It's you see how it changes a kiddo and their family when they're going through really difficult times.
Yeah.
Not just to cope, but like to get stronger, you know. I'm sure a clown or that kind of thing too. That's awesome. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, I think you might like it. Ever growing. Can you talk a little bit about your work with Space at Ryder Farm?
Oh, sure.
How did you get involved with that?
Sure. So way back, I always forget the starting year. I think it was 2010. So Susan Goodwillie, his old, long dear friends with Emily Simonis, who is the executive director of Space Ryder Farm. And back in when it was just a little seed of an idea in Emily's head, she approached Susan about... So Space Ryder Farm is a artist and... workshop retreat space on a working organic farm.
Yes, and I told Emily I want to have her on. So, at some point, I'll have her on.
She would be so great to have on. It's over 100 acres, lakefront property, one of the oldest organic farms in this area, still owned and operated by the same family since 1795. And Emily is seventh generation of this family. We're still very connected to the farm and have gone up one summer to visit and kind of had this idea of creating this space. But some of the structures, you know, one of our main structures was built in 1795.
Oh, my gosh.
And when Emily saw it, just needed a little, it needed some TLC and some love, you know, in order to come to any sort of approaching her creative idea. So Susan Goodwillie is a very dear friend of mine. She and I met at Williamstown Theater Festival in 2008. And when Emily and Susan were talking about first steps, they thought that they could get a group of artists together to go up over the over long weekends and, you know, scrape walls, organize linens, paint, spackle, do all that, break leaves, re-landscape, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan asked me to do it, and I said, sure. And so I went up. I think I spent like 4 or 5 weekends that summer up there doing that, and have stayed involved ever since. Since that time, Emily has become one of my dearest friends, and it really has grown from this sort of small, you know, we were like cooking off of like a plugged-in like burner for ourselves, and now it's like this, it's really wild how it's grown and it's changed, and it's not changed, it's just grown into itself, you know. So the past few summers I've gone up and I've cooked, I've gone up like a month at a time and cooked for the residents on the farm, because we provide 3 farm fresh meals.
How many people is that usually?
Oh gosh, it varies anywhere from like 15 to 30 people. When I've been there for some of the larger groups, because I come from a really big family. And you can do this part. I'm like, sure.
I'll figure it out.
And it's really fun, actually. It's sort of meditative to like chop zucchini for an hour, you know, literally for an hour. And it's a really rewarding, it's such a different kind of experience, and it's so beautiful up there, and you meet so many cool people. I find it really relaxing. This is actually the first summer that I'm not going up there as like a part of the team, and it's hard. I miss it a lot,
you
know, but hope to remain connected in another capacity. But it's a really special place.
I'm sure just having that place to get out of the city, too, was just so helpful.
My parents came to see Food Odyssey 2 years ago, and I took them up to see it, and it was really special to get to show it to them.
Yeah.
And it's also grown into working with nonprofits and NGOs, and that speaks to my heart a lot, too. So I think that, it's sort of this delightful, special place that I feel very lucky to have somehow been connected to from the beginning.
And were you involved with the Food Odyssey from the very beginning?
I was. Nick Chosey, who you've had on your podcast.
Yes. This is funny that I'm having you on right after Josh. So
I
wish you all could have seen the Food Odyssey, but we're just going to keep talking about it.
Maybe
hopefully it'll come back someday.
It will be like a concert reading of it someday or something.
Yeah.
I remember sitting across from Perone Yousafzada, the director of the Food Odyssey way back when, probably 2010, I think, and we were having lunch, and she first was like, you know, I've been thinking of this play, like, and it was just, I think it was maybe, like, the second time she'd ever said it out loud. She was sort of, like, about food, maybe farm culture, or just our relationship to food in this country, and how the, you know, we were talking about Space on Writer Farm, I think, at the time, too, and the genesis of that. And, I was like, yeah, you should do that, you know? And she's like, would you like to be involved if, like, we get a workshop together? And I was like, yeah, sure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Nick was also involved because he and Perone are dear friends. So, yeah, from the very beginning, when we just were going to people's houses and sharing meals and talking about food, like, that's how it really started. It was just, like, we would have a theme and we would just talk. And then we slowly started to crawl and then to walk and then to play, you know. But that was a really special. I've never been involved in a project like that before or since.
It was devised from the ground up.
From the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I never would have thought myself one to be very good at that, I guess, you know. But to be in a room with lots of other people who have different gifts and to work, because there are so many people who came in and out of this project.
Yeah.
And all of them were present in the voice, I think, of the final thing. It was really special, a big special thing to get to do.
Yeah.
And a reminder while in school, like, oh, right, I'm also this person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can have both of these things in me. Because I don't want to come across being like, I found school and now things are so great and so different, because I still miss it. I still have moments where I go to see a play and that kind of like magical thing that you feel like by the end.
I'm like, I want to do that.
Backstage.
Yeah.
And you're like waiting for the light to go for me to enter.
Yeah.
You know? That's absolutely still present.
Has your writing ever been in play form, or has it been more just personal?
No, I've tried from time to time, but
me too.
It just isn't my skill.
Yeah.
Especially now my current boyfriend is a writer, and he's so skilled at it. You know,
right.
Went to school for it. I'm like, oh, right.
Right.
It takes a lot of skill
right.
and a lot of talent. And, but no, I just really journal for myself. I was part of a writing group for a while. Not related to theater, but related to adult survivors of various childhood illness. And we did a lot of creative writing together and poetry, and that was really lovely.
Oh, that's cool.
I felt, you know, some poems would come out that I was like, oh, it's not half bad, you know?
That's really cool.
But for the most part, it's usually just personal journaling.
Yeah.
Doodling.
What is it like for you guys being in a relationship with another artist?
I love it.
Yeah.
Know? I've always generally been attracted to artists because it's that thing, right? Of like, there's like a string between you of like,
mm-hmm.
oh, I see you. And you
I understand.
See you. Yeah, we get it.
Yeah.
Even though he does a different art form and my life is what it is, like, there's something actually for me that's special about him having seen me act. He saw Food Odyssey.
Yeah.
And for him to know that part of my history.
Yeah, it would be strange if he never got a chance to.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've met, like, say he weren't to be an artist, I think I would be afraid of someone being like, so wait, what? Like, wait, who are you? Like, what's going on? Like, you do these two different kind of things.
Right. But not like, really, right?
Yeah. So, like, acting, you're not going to do
that.
That's
not.
Like, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
Something about having somebody that gets it and gets the complexity of the business, too, and the journey of the business allows me to hold both parts of myself in a way that I don't think I was expecting when he and I started dating. Like, it's been such a lovely byproduct of our relationship. He sees plays all the time, and
yeah.
I read his plays all the time, and it's kind of going back to your first question of, like, how to keep buoyant amidst working with sick kiddos. It's like, oh, I'll go read one of his plays or go see play with him, and it helps so much, you know? So I totally value that part of our relationship. I don't think it's for everyone. I've met people who, like, are like, I can't date another actor or another writer or another director. I think it's one of those things, like, get older, like, to each their own.
Yeah,
know?
I think
like,
it just depends on the people.
Yeah. But for me, it's hugely helpful.
Yeah.
It's been a really special part of our relationship.
Yeah. Well, can we come back around to the main question? And
mm-hmm.
how do you avoid the dark side
mm-hmm.
these days?
Yeah. I really do feel like going back to that initial conversation with that one mentor of, filling my life up with things that speak to my heart. It can be called balance. It can be called a lot of things. But say I've had a hard day at work or with a kiddo at the hospital, I like to come home and I'll cook a meal. I really enjoy cooking. And it's simple, and it sounds really simple, but there's been days where I've come home and I've even said to my boyfriend, like, I need to, like, not talk for half an hour. I need to go and, like, just chop some vegetables, you know?
It's a ritual for you.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also respecting of that sadness or that frustration or whatever the feeling might be. Because now I start to sometimes feel existentially, like, you know, working with kids who are sick, it's hard. It's a difficult thing to see. So for me, it's almost like a letting go, like a letting go of that part of it and doing the work that I can do and focusing on what tools I do have and how I can be productive. And really working to through cutting vegetables or talking or going for a walk or journaling, trying to find peace with the things that I cannot control that are otherwise overwhelming.
Yeah, you're a witness in such an interesting way to these, not only the kids, but their families, mm-hmm. what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Sort of my job, they call it in school, like creating a holding space, you know, being a vessel for other people, or just being a witness to their pain or their grief or their joy or their successes. And I think being respectful of that for me and reflecting on that and letting it take the space it takes up in me is necessary, you know? And again, going in when I really feel dark or I really feel like that kind of thing coming, like looking at it in the face as opposed to trying to go away from it, you know? Be like, okay, so what is it about right now?
Mm.
And what help and support or outlet do I need, you know?
Right.
Because otherwise I feel like it would just persist for me.
What else did I want to ask you?
In terms of being an actor, you know, again, I was that girl who, like, at our senior showcase would hear, if I were to hear someone like me talking, I'd be like, that's not going to be me, you know? Like,
yeah.
I would reject it outright. And I actually recently met a girl at a show or a reading who was, she just moved to New York 3 weeks ago. And I could feel it. I could, like, see myself. And it's like, oh, yeah. And she's like, I just went to this really sweet, lovely young woman. She's like, I just went to this place. It's in Union Square. It's called the Green Market. And I'm like, yeah, lovely, you know? And you could tell it fed her up. But she's also, like, terrified and also just feeling all of it. And to be on the other side of it now, to, like, see it 10 years later, and to be like, oh, I'm that other person. I'm the older person who's, like, been around the block, been through the ringer, been up and down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found myself being very gentle with her. I found myself, if you ever need to talk to somebody.
That's so sweet.
Please, you know, because I feel like I had a couple of those when I first moved to New York.
Yeah.
You know, that were helpful. But it was a really strange feeling to be on the other side of it, you know.
Yeah.
And to feel the pride for what I'm doing now, even though I think that 22, 23-year-old me would not have been prideful of it, is an interesting place to be at now, too, you know? Because we have such expectations where we think it's all going to look
right.
Like, and it never goes that way, you know?
I know what I wanted to ask you. Because you've been in New York for such a long time.
Yeah.
And you're about to leave for, is it 1 year or two?
1 year.
It's 1 year.
Yeah.
About to go to Boston, right?
Boston, yep.
For a really great program, which you can tell them about if you want. But how are you feeling about New York City these days?
It's interesting.
Like, long term.
Because
you're about to take a break.
I'm about to take a break. And not going that far. And going to a place that I'm familiar with, where I went to undergrad, Boston.
That's true. So you have a history there.
Yeah, it's, like, not a totally new place. I'm renting, like, some furnished rooms, so it's not totally, like... I'm staying. It's almost physical.
Do you see you're going to have a roommate?
I'm living in, like, a house with these two ladies who work at a college rent out. So I'll live alone.
It's like a boarding house.
I know, kind of.
It's like you're Joe in Little Women.
Yeah. Oh, like, I want to do like a year-long play somewhere, you know, like yeah. staying in some weird theater housing. But I've had moments walking around the past few months, and I feel weird saying it out loud. I know that I have said it out loud. I'm like, am I saying bye to New York too? I don't think the plan is to come back here, you know.
Right.
But there is a lot of, so I have this fellowship is in pediatric palliative care. And there's a lot of that work on the West Coast. There's a lot
really?
Of hospitals who have that implemented in their kind of hospital systems out there. Or Austin, and I'm from Texas. Austin has a lot of that mm-hmm. there too.
Is it kind of a newer it's system newer, that not everywhere yeah. has embraced yet?
So palliative care in the adult world, which a lot of people think of hospice, but there's also like hospital palliative care for people who aren't at end of life. It's been around for a little while now. It's starting to really pick up speed now as, you know, the demographics of our population begin to age. But pediatric palliative care is, it's not emerging. Like, the team I'm about to join has been around for like 20-some years. But it's still small. It's still kind of trying to get its corners. I think for a lot of reasons, it's more difficult to fund things like that for children. People like to talk about kids who are maybe at end of life, understandably, and it's just, it's a difficult kind of service to provide education for. A family might hear that and be like, my kid's not. But so much of palliative care is, again, not about end of life. It's about improving quality of life alongside complex illness, and that could be chronic illness, that could be just the side effects of treatment, you know, that could be emotional side effects of treatment
mm-hmm.
For a person who would go on to live a very long and very fruitful life. So sometimes I've thought about, like, because I'm sort of open to see where this fellowship takes me since it's a year long. And as I get a little older and I start to think about having a family,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that I want to raise a kid in New York
yeah.
for myself. You know, I don't have any answers or any sort of definitive things, but New York is hard, you know. I love it. Like, there's days where the air is just right, and I'm going to, like, meet a friend, and I feel so, like, Carrie Bradshaw, like, on the street, like, no, this is my town. And that is most of the feeling, but then there's feelings where, like, my internship this past year was an hour commute each way, and by the end of it, I was like, I just, on the 6 too, so it's like sardine town.
Right.
It's like, I just can't, that just is, you know. And also, it's a very expensive city to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me is wondering, like, do I value how much I'm paying to live here as much as I value the experience of living here? There's more questions right now, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my first, like, year in New York, I was almost having an allergic reaction to it, you know. And I've had, you know, I've had bed bugs, I've gotten them. I've, like,
oh my gosh.
The full rigmarole of experience and stayed and stuck around. So I almost feel like now I want to stay. I want to be here.
Right.
You've
gotten through the beginning.
My way through, you know. But yeah. Priorities change. And
be interested to talk to you later this year.
Yeah.
See how your time away is.
Yeah. Well, you better be talking to me.
I know. I'll have to come and visit.
Yeah, you should. Or I'm going to be back in front of a lot.
We've already touched on a lot of this, yeah. like with your cooking and everything, but yeah. are there other concrete things that you turn back to when you're in the dark side, like a book or music or anything yeah. like that?
I love to read. Mm-hmm. The past few years I've had to read a lot of, like, homework, but there is a book, and then there have been books that have really influenced that time. I'm a big fan of Gilda Radner.
Mm-hmm.
The original cast of Saturday Night Live.
Uh-huh.
She has an autobiography called It's Always Something, which is a tagline of Roseanne, Roseanna Dana. So it's always something. If it's not one thing, it's another. And it's such a beautiful book. She writes it, you know, from she died of ovarian cancer, but this book was written after her first battle with the disease.
Mm.
But it also outlines her early career and her childhood and her relationship to SNL and New York and herself as an actress and her relationships, like, with Gene Wilder, etc. and it's so rich. It kind of reminds me of this dialogue with you a little bit.
Oh, I gotta read it.
It's so, I've read it maybe 18 times. I'm not exaggerating. I did an excerpt of it for my senior thesis. Like, I'm a little, and I still, I'll recommend it to people to read.
Awesome.
And I get something out of it different each time. I mean, it's a very, I mean, it's written, it's, you know, it's not like the most, like, unbelievably profound book necessarily, but to me it is. And to me it's spoken a lot to me about various parts of my life, whether it be theater and acting and self-perception and being a woman, relationships, or about illness and about you know, mortality and things like that too. So I find it to be a really rich book. In the past, it's now been made into a movie, which I didn't see, and I worry that it sort of tainted the book, but the book Wild by Cheryl Strayed.
Yes, I have seen the movie and not read the book, I think.
I love the book, because it is sort of this not-perfect woman who, you know, goes through a journey as she hikes a piece of the, what is it, Pacific Coast?
I think so.
Trail.
Mm-hmm.
So that book was one that meant a lot to me when I read it. Cause I read it like right as I was getting ready to start for school, and kind of like even the night before I started my first class, as opposed to like sleeping and being like, I'm so excited to start school. I was like, this is the truth. I was like crying a little bit and I couldn't sleep. And I was like, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing? And she outlines something, so I won't ruin it, but she outlines a sort of a similar thing the night before she goes on her hike. And I recalled it that evening. I'm a big fan, you have it on your thing, but of Dr. Seuss. I'm working with kiddos, there will be times where I'll read, there's like a, What Was I Scared Of? It's a little short story in the book that includes the speeches and so many Daves and some other stories. And it's about, you know, this little character who's afraid of this pair of empty, of pale green pants with nobody inside them. And he keeps following, like, running.
I haven't read that one.
Oh my gosh, it's the best. And, I mean, I was read it as a kid, too, but I found myself reading it to a kid in my first year of school, and I got really teary-eyed. Like, it's, you're so afraid of this thing, and ultimately there's nothing to be afraid of, and actually then you welcome it into your life. It can benefit you, you know.
And then the last question is, have you seen any art recently that you want to recommend?
Yeah. Any art recently? I love how open that is. In terms of plays, I saw, it feels a little biased because it's like things my friends are in.
That's great.
I love them most. But my very dear friend Heather Lind is in a show called Incognito at MTC. And it's four actors playing 21 different parts.
Oh my gosh.
And they're just all so skilled. All four actors are just like, oh, you guys are all great. And you're all honest actors and hardworking. And that was really lovely to see. I just saw my very dear friend Joe Tippett in a show called Indian Summer at Playwrights Horizons. I think it's about to open in the next couple of days. Also really excellent. I saw The Humans on Broadway.
I really want to see it.
I also saw The Father on Broadway, which has been getting huge reviews. And I thought it was really beautiful. I wish the Picasso exhibit was still going on, because in terms of art, I saw that at MoMA and thought it was outstanding.
Yeah, that was really beautiful. Wonderful. Thank you, Rachel.
This is so lovely and fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing what you're doing.
This was great.
So
love you.
Love you.
Bye.
To the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.